Isaiah, chapters 4 and 5, the fifth talk in a series on the book of Isaiah, was presented by David Crabtree on April 1, 2012, at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2012. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole, for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction, all other rights reserved.
We're back in the book of Isaiah, looking at chapters 4 and 5 today. Every week after I teach, I think back at things I said and things that I should have made clearer and things that I didn't say but should have said and all that sort of thing. I won't inflict all of that on you. But I do want to talk about one thing that I mentioned last time. That I was answering the question, is it possible for the Bible to be an idol, the way I've been talking about it? And as you'll recall, I'm using the term idol in a way that is not quite the way that Isaiah has been using it, but I think is in keeping with the way that Isaiah has been using it. There is a concept that Isaiah has introduced, and that is a kind of inappropriate trust in things other than God. And I have appropriated the term idolatry to cover all of those kinds of inappropriate trusts in things other than God. And the question was, can the Bible be an idol? And the answer to that is, I think yes. In fact, I think anything can be an idol. We can put inappropriate trust in absolutely anything. And I use the example in my life of thinking back, and it's difficult, but thinking back 30 years or so, how I looked at things. And at the time, I was a vehement inerrantist and believed fully in the authority of the Bible. I have not changed that, but what has changed is I've thought a lot about what is an error. And that's a much more difficult question than one would immediately assume it to be. It's a complicated issue, what is an error? And in that respect, my thinking has changed quite a bit. That things that I was afraid to say were not an error 30 years ago, now I'm more comfortable saying that those things really are not errors. And I said that looking back at myself, or looking forward at myself now from 30 years ago, I would probably have called myself now a heretic. That may be a little bit strong, but I certainly would have been worried about myself and my beliefs as they are now. And what I've come to see is that what Isaiah is emphasizing is that God is our rock and our only rock. And it is possible in life circumstances to make other things your rock. The thing that's firm, the thing that you're anchored to, the thing that you know will ultimately pull you through, the thing that you are counting on for salvation. And it's possible to invest that kind of trust in virtually anything, and in doing so, commit idolatry. I suspect that going back 30 years, part of my thinking was I have to hold on tightly to inerrancy and my conception of inerrancy as it was at the time, because if you chip away at that, then my whole system of faith and belief could fall apart. And what I realized since then is God's better than that. That I don't have to worry about holding on to that particular tenet clenched in my fist, holding on to it desperately. God is the maker of my salvation. And if there are adjustments that need to be made in the way that I look at the Bible, I'm free to make those. And God will bring me through. God will guide me through the process. He will save me nevertheless. So it's important to hold to God rather than to other things. And it's so easy to hold to other things, even things that seem good and right to hold on to. Holding on to the Bible is a good thing, but one must hold on to it rightly. One must allow it to be what God intended it to be and not insist that it be something else for your own psychological reasons or whatever. So that was the point that I was attempting to make, and hopefully this time it was clearer. Okay, in Isaiah 3 and down to verse 1 of chapter 4, Isaiah's been making the case, and this he's been building this up. Chapter 1 is kind of an introduction to the book as a whole. Then he expands on that introduction in chapters 2 through 5. And so we're seeing an expansion on that. And in that expansion, Isaiah has made the point that Israel has taken God for granted, and all of the care that God has provided for Israel, they have taken that for granted. And because they have taken that for granted, they haven't recognized what God has done for them, they have gone looking elsewhere for safety and security. And they've looked for it several places, but quite notably, they've looked for it in wealth. And so accumulation of wealth has become a goal of theirs to provide them with the security that God is not providing them. They don't see God providing that for them. Wealth will provide it. In so doing, they have run roughshod over those in their society who are the least capable of defending themselves, the orphans and the widows. So Isaiah's looking at Judean society, and he points to the fact that widows and orphans are not cared for as evidence that they have lost, the people of Judah have lost their way. As a result, because they have gone looking for security and safety elsewhere besides God, God's response is, I'm going to withdraw all means of support from Israel. I'm taking away food, I'm taking away water, I'm taking away their civic order. I'm going to take everything away, and what they're going to see is their idols can't come through. Their idols can't provide that. And he singles out the ruling class for its part in this. They will have a higher level of accountability, and they will suffer as a result of that which is coming, the judgment that is coming. And that's where things ended after verse 1 of chapter 4, then the rest of chapter 4. Starting with verse 2, in that day the branch of the Lord will be beautiful and glorious, and the fruit of the earth will be pride and the adornment of the survivors of Israel. And it will come about that he who is left in Zion and remains in Jerusalem will be called holy, everyone who is recorded for life in Jerusalem. When the Lord has washed away the filth of the daughters of Zion and purged the bloodshed of Jerusalem from her midst, by the spirit of judgment and the spirit of burning, then the Lord will create over the whole area of Mount Zion and over her assemblies a cloud by day, even smoke, and the brightness of a flaming fire by night. For over all the glory will be a canopy, and there will be a shelter to give shade from the heat by day, and refuge and protection from the storm and the rain. It starts with in that day. In chapters 2 and 3, in that day shows up about 7 times, I think. So in that day is capturing something. Remember that it started in chapter 2 saying in the last days. So presumably what's being talked about is something that's going to happen at the end of time. Now, when thinking about what God says with respect to time, you have to acknowledge, you have to recognize that an infinite being is time challenged. He loses track of time. We keep track of it much better than he does. For him, a day is as 1,000 years, or is it the other way around? So in the last days, We don't know how long that is. But we're talking about the end of history. Then it goes on in chapter 2 and 3, talking about in that day. And it's not clear to me whether all of this is occurring in the last days, whether the last days is a very long period of time. That could very well be. It could be that the last days is millennia. None of that is clear, but in that day seems to indicate the time when God rouses to action. And in particular, rouses to action in judgment. In judgment and bringing things to a conclusion. So in that day, the branch of the Lord will be beautiful and glorious, and the fruit of the earth will be the pride and the adornment of the survivors of Israel. Now, it could be talking about, in this verse, it could be talking about merely the fact that Israel will begin to prosper, talking about a situation in which Israel flourishes, and that flourishing is epitomized by crops growing and being productive and abundant and becoming the pride and the adornment of the survivors of Israel. However, the word branch can also mean sprout, so something just emerging from the ground. And that term, a sprout, shows up a number of times in other prophetic books. In particular, it shows up about half a dozen times in Jeremiah. Jeremiah would have been written about the same time as Isaiah, maybe a little bit later. But let's look at a couple of passages in Jeremiah. Jeremiah 23, 5, and 6. It says, Jeremiah 23, 5, and 6. "Behold, the days are coming, declares the Lord, when I shall raise up for David a righteous branch or sprout. And he will reign as king and act wisely and do justice and righteousness in the land. In his days, Judah will be saved, and Israel will dwell securely. And this is his name by which he will be called, the Lord our righteousness." Another one, Jeremiah 33:15. "In those days and at that time, I will cause a righteous branch or sprout of David to spring forth, and he shall execute justice and righteousness on the earth. In those days, Judah shall be saved, and Jerusalem shall dwell in safety. And this is the name by which she shall be called, the Lord is our righteousness." So my suspicion is this term sprout takes on a technical meaning that would be identifiable by the readers. And that is, it's coming to mean that which indicates a new emergence of life. And in particular, it's with respect to the Messiah, Jesus. So I suspect that what's being talked about here in Isaiah in the second verse is that in that day that the sprout, that is the Messiah, will be beautiful and glorious, and the fruit of the earth will be the pride and adornment of the survivors of Israel. In other words, a righteous order will be established. A righteous order is established, I assume, by the Messiah in some sense. And Israel, under that rule, will prosper. And those who have survived from Israel will take pride in this development that has happened. Verse 3, "And it will come about that he who is left in Zion and remains in Jerusalem will be called holy, everyone who is recorded for life in Jerusalem." So now we're talking about apparently this remnant that's been hinted at before, and it will be talked about more as we proceed in Isaiah, a remnant that survives, a remnant that remains after all of the judgment. And this remnant will be characterized by being holy. So we're talking about a remnant that remains after the purging has happened within Israel, and all of the rebellion has been purged out, as it talks about in verse 4, talking about the the Lord washing away the filth of the daughters of Zion and purging the bloodshed of Jerusalem from her midst. In chapter 3, it had talked about the daughters of Zion and their arrogance and how their adornment. And I suggested that that seems to be kind of a metaphor for Israel as a whole, that Israel as a whole is proud, arrogant, and decked out in wealth and trusting in that wealth. But that is all going to be purged out. That's all going to be purified. And all that will be left then is those who remain that are called holy. And how will that happen? It will happen by a spirit of judgment and a spirit of burning. And I think here the term spirit indicates God's movement. It's God's movement in judgment and God's movement in burning. And I think there's a sense in which it's a literal burning. It's a destruction that will take place. And that will purge Israel of its filth and the bloodshed. And as I've mentioned before, I don't think this is talking about the fact that there are a lot of murderers in Israel, that kind of bloodshed, but in the sense of there are a lot of people within Israel who don't have respect for their fellow human beings. So it's murder in that respect. It is people who are quick to refer to others as fool and call others fool, as Jesus talks about in the Sermon of the Mount, that is tantamount to killing. But all of that will be purged away. And then the Lord will create over the whole area of Mount Zion and her assemblies a cloud by day, even smoke, and the brightness of a flaming fire by night. For over all the glory will be a canopy. That's a fascinating image. Obviously, it's a reference back to the Exodus. So the implication is that the time is coming. And when? It's in that day. The time is coming when God is going to act in Israel as he did millennia ago. That is to say, overtly, that he will be supernaturally present as he had been at the time of the Exodus, present in the day in the form of a cloud, present at night in the form of a pillar of fire. And he will be a protective canopy protecting them from, and it talks about the heat and the rain. I suspect that what that means is the whole spectrum of catastrophe. So God is going to be the provider of safety and security that the people of Israel have wanted so badly, and therefore, and for that sake, have turned their backs on God. God, in the end, will provide that safety and security. Okay, so this is just one more snapshot of the glorious future that awaits Israel. We've seen another snapshot. There have been a couple of other snapshots already, and you put them together and you get this more full picture of what Israel's future will be at the very end of time. And it is a glorious future that awaits them. And the implication that Isaiah made before is, therefore, live in accordance with this future that awaits you. Okay, chapter 5 then introduces an image that's been alluded to already, but it develops it more fully and then expounds upon that. Let's look at the image, verses 1 and 2. Let me sing now for my well-beloved, a song of my beloved concerning his vineyard. My well-beloved had a vineyard on a fertile hill, and he dug it all around, removed its stones, and planted it with the choicest vine. And he built a tower in the middle of it, and hewed out a wine vat in it. And he expected it to produce good grapes, but it produced only worthless ones. An interesting beginning to this. He says, let me sing now for my well-beloved. It's like someone going for advice, and they say, I have a friend who, and they don't tell you who it is, and they're trying to distance themselves from that and the problem that they want to talk about. Well, this is, I want to sing now for my well-beloved. It doesn't say who the well-beloved is, but it becomes clear later that that's God himself. Okay, the song has to do with a vineyard. And this vineyard was one that was very carefully planned out and very carefully created. It was created on a hill with fertile soil. The plants were chosen well. All the stones were removed. The holes were dug for the plants to be put in. The soil prepared well. A tower was built in the middle of it for protection. And a vat was hewn out of the stone in preparation for the abundant harvest to be, for the wine of the harvest to be stored in. So he had every reason to expect that this vineyard would be a great vineyard and a very productive vineyard. But what happened? It only produced worthless grapes. All that effort and no good grapes were produced. As we'll see later, even more was done for this vineyard than is listed in this initial song. But that's the problem that's being described. Verses 3 through 6. And now, O inhabitants of Jerusalem and men of Judah, judge between me and my vineyard. What more was there to do for my vineyard that I have not done in it? Why, when I expected it to produce good grapes, did it produce worthless ones? So now let me tell you what I am going to do to my vineyard. I will remove its hedge, and it will be consumed. I will break down its wall, and it will become trampled ground. And I will lay it waste. It will not be pruned or hoed, but briar and thorns will come up. It will also charge the cloud. I will also charge the clouds to rain no rain on it. So what's happening here is, it becomes clear later, God is the beloved, the well-beloved, and he's encouraging the people of Judah and Jerusalem to look at the situation through his eyes and think about how they would respond. What's the appropriate response to this kind of situation? He's encouraged them to do that elsewhere. We saw that earlier in chapter 1. He said, come, let us reason together. God is inviting them to look at things through his eyes, look at things from his perspective, and they will see that what God is doing makes all kinds of sense. God had done absolutely everything to prepare this vineyard well. He had every reason to expect a good crop, and what happened? Nothing but worthless grapes. So what is he going to do? What he's going to do is withdraw his care. Interestingly, it doesn't describe any positive action on God's part. God doesn't enter in and actually punish, do anything to destroy the garden itself. He does things to no longer protect it. So it's tearing down, he says to remove the hedge. There was no mention of the hedge earlier. That is an additional thing that he had done to provide protection for it. He removes the hedge, breaks down the wall. He says, I will lay it waste, but it's a kind of passive laying waste. He will not prune it or hoe it. He will let the briars and the thorns come up, and he will tell the clouds not to rain on it. So he's going to deprive it of all the care and provision that previously he had provided for it. Then he explains in verse 7 what this is analogous to. For the vineyard of the Lord of hosts is the house of Israel, and the men of Judah his delightful plant. Thus he looked for justice, but behold, bloodshed. For righteousness, but behold, a cry of distress. So now the analogy is made apparent. It is God who had provided all of this care and concern for Israel and Judah. They are the vineyard that God had planted and prepared. And he expected a good harvest, But he didn't get a good harvest. He had expected justice. What did he get? Bloodshed. He had expected righteousness. What did he get? A cry of distress. And I think that's from primarily the cry of distress from those who were disadvantaged, the widows and the orphans. Okay, expanding on this then, verses 8 through 12. Woe to those who add house to house and join field to field until there is no more room, so that you have to live alone in the midst of the land. In my ears the Lord of hosts has sworn, surely many houses shall become desolate, even great and fine ones without occupants. For 10 acres of vineyards will yield only one bath of wine, and a homer of seed will yield but an ephah of grain. Woe to those who rise early in the morning, that they may pursue strong drink, who stay up late in the evening, that wine may inflame them. And their banquets are accompanied by lyre and harp, by tambourine and flute, and by wine. But they do not pay attention to the deeds of the Lord, nor do they consider the work of his hands. So he singles out, there are two woes here. We're going to see that there will be another four woes that follow after this. So it's a total of six woes. The first two seem to be addressed to two segments of Judean society. The first one seems to be addressed to the wealthy in their midst. The second woe seems to be addressed to the commoners. To the wealthy, he says, woe to those who add house to house and join field to field. So presumably what's happening is the wealthy are just buying up real estate. They're buying up real estate not because they need additional real estate, but real estate becomes their security. It becomes their safety. In case anything happens to them, they will still have lots of resources left in the form of land and real estate. They are accumulating these large estates to the point that they have no neighbors. They have added so much to their estates that they have driven away all of their friends and neighbors, is apparently the situation. He says, until there is no more room, so that you have to live alone in the midst of the land. They've bought up so much land, now they're all isolated. And what will happen? What will God do in response to that land grab? He says, those houses will become desolate, and even the nice houses will be unoccupied, without occupants. And the farmland, it will no longer produce. It's not going to be productive. It will not provide the wealth that they had hoped that it would provide. So God is going to negate, he's going to make all of that land acquisition turn into a futile effort. The second woe is to those who rise early in the morning that they may pursue strong drink, and who stay up late in the evening that wine may inflame them. So now we have another situation, another group, another portion of the population, and I think this is the commoners, who have given themselves over to, basically given themselves over to dissipation, that their way of dealing with a difficult and insecure life is to amuse themselves to death. They've taken to strong drink, morning and evening. They have banquets that are accompanied by lyre, harp, tambourine, flute, and by wine. And interestingly, a theme that we've seen before from the very beginning, but they do not pay attention to the deeds of the Lord, nor do they consider the work of his hands. Again, their insecurity is born of not being attentive to what God has done for them. If they were attentive to what God has been doing for them, they would realize his ongoing love and support, care and provision that he has made for them and would continue to provide for them. But no, they've given themselves over to distraction. Verses 13 through 17, therefore my people go into exile for their lack of knowledge, and their honorable men are famished, and their multitude is parched with thirst. Therefore Sheol has enlarged its throat and opened its mouth without measure. And Jerusalem's splendor, her multitude, her din of revelry, and the jubilant within her descend into it. So the common man will be humbled and the man of importance abased. The eyes of the proud also will be abased. But the Lord of hosts will be exalted in judgment, and the holy God will show himself holy in righteousness. Then the lambs will graze as in their pasture, and strangers will eat in the waste places of the wealthy. So in response to the fact that the people of Israel have turned to these other idols for their safety and security, he is sending them into exile. For their lack of knowledge, I think their lack of knowledge here is their lack of knowledge of God. It's their lack of recognition for what God has done, their lack of knowledge of what kind of God he is. They haven't taken the time and shown the interest in getting to know God as he exists and what he's done for them. And their honorable men will be famished. Their multitude is parched with thirst. That's the cue that I'm taking when I read into the first two woes, that the first one has to do with the wealthy, the well-to-do, and the second woe has to do with the commoners, because here it says their honorable men are famished, they're without food. They were the ones who had accumulated a lot of wealth, had a lot of farmland, but it's not producing anymore. That's why they're famished. The second group, the commoners, are parched with thirst. What have they done to cope with their lives? They've given it over to drink. And how's God going to respond? He's going to take their drink away. They will be parched with thirst. So then, Sheol has enlarged its throat and opened its mouth without measure, just opening wide, and Jerusalem, and in all of its revelry and all of its splendor, marches right into Sheol's open mouth. So a day of judgment, as we've seen before, and verses 15 and 16 are essentially the same refrain that we've seen before. We saw it two or three times in chapter 2. Yeah, it was just in chapter 2. But that theme that refrain that we've seen before, the common man will be humbled, the man of importance abased, the eyes of the proud also will be abased. That when the judgment comes, man is going to be humbled. Man, the creature, is going to be put in his rightful place with respect to the Creator. And God will be exalted. He will be shown as the Creator that he is, the one who is truly in charge, truly holy and just. Verse 17 then seems to refer to a situation in which Israel has been made desolate. It has no population anymore. Lambs graze as in their pasture. There's nothing left there but pasture land. And strangers will eat in the waste places of the wealthy. So strangers, people wandering through, are eating in the places that the wealthy had built their estates. All of that will be wiped away, and we'll have nothing but lambs and foreigners wandering through. Verses 18 through 23. Woe to those who drag iniquity with the cords of falsehood and sin as if with cart ropes, who say, let him make speed, let him hasten his work that we may see it, and let the purpose of the Holy One of Israel draw near and come to pass that we may know it. Woe to those who call evil good and good evil, who substitute darkness for light and light for darkness, who substitute bitter for sweet and sweet for bitter. Woe to those who are wise in their own eyes and clever in their own sight. Woe to those who are heroes in drinking wine and valiant men in mixing strong drink, who justify the wicked for a bribe and take away the rights of the ones who are in the right. So now we have four more woes. These seem to be addressed, I think, to Judah as a whole, but it is singling out a kind of rebelliousness, a kind of blatant rebelliousness towards God. The first one seems to be addressed to those who say that the things that have been predicted, the judgment, the people who have, the prophet, and probably Isaiah, the prophecies that have been made with respect to the judgment that's coming to Israel, they aren't going to happen. And they are kind of taunting the prophet, saying, bring him on. It says in verse 19, who say, let him make speed, let him hasten his work, that we may see it. They're saying, come on, show us. And let the purpose of the Holy One of Israel draw near, the Holy One of Israel, kind of mocking the words that Isaiah has used, and he's going to use it again in a little bit as a name for God, kind of mocking that. And let the purpose of the Holy One of Israel draw near and come to pass, that we may know it. This is blatant rebelliousness, kind of taunting God. Come on, or Isaiah, I'm sure, is who they're taunting. Come on, let's see it. Bring it on. And Isaiah is saying, woe to those people. The second one, those who call evil good and good evil. It's those who invert the proper values in life, the order that God has established. They're justifying and rationalizing their behavior, claiming that what they're doing is good and proper, when in fact it's rebellious and evil. 21, those who are wise in their own eyes and clever in their own sight. There's a wisdom there, but it's a wisdom not from God. It's a cleverness, but a cleverness to their own destruction. And then the last two verses, it's the first is to those who, woe to those who are heroes. But what are the heroes with respect to? They're heroes with respect to drinking wine. And woe to those who justify. That's a good thing, isn't it, to justify? But these are people who justify the wicked for a bribe. So it's turning these things that should be good things, heroes and justifiers, but they are heroes in a sense that is perverse. And they are justifiers in a sense that is perverse and wicked. Woe to them. So a judgment is coming, 24 and 25. Therefore, as a tongue of fire consumes stubble and dry grass collapses into the flame, so their root will become like rot and their blossom blow away as dust. For they have rejected the law of the Lord of hosts and despised the word of the Holy One of Israel. On this account, the anger of the Lord has burned against his people, and he has stretched out his hand against them and struck them down. And the mountains quaked, and their corpses lay in like refuse in the middle of the streets. For all this, his anger is not spent, but his hand is still stretched out. So a judgment is coming, and he uses two images, both indicating the frailty of Israel. The first one, it uses the image of fire sweeping over dry grass. Israel is like dry grass. The judgment that's coming is like fire that's just going to sweep across it. And if any of you have burned a grass field, a dry grass field, that's an amazing sight. It goes fast, hot and fast. The second image is like a tree or a plant that's root has all rotted away. And now it's just a wobbly dead stem. And their blossom will blow away as dust. So the blossoms that this plant, whatever it is, whether it's a tree or a bush or whatever, its roots have rotted, and the blossoms just dry and wither away and blow with the wind. The judgment is going to come on Israel in that way and show how frail Israel is. Why? Because they rejected the law of the Lord of hosts. We've seen that before. And despised the word of the Holy One of Israel. It's using the name the Holy One of Israel again. in repeating what was said by the skeptics in verse 19, the Holy One of Israel. So the Holy One of Israel, he will show himself. He will come in judgment. So verse 25, God's anger is burning against his people. His hand is stretched out. He struck them down. It refers to the mountains quaking. There was an earthquake that occurred during the reign of King Uzziah. And I can't remember whether it's in, I think that's mentioned in Kings, but it might be Chronicles. I can't remember which one. Quite a number of people were killed. And so this seems to be a reference to that first, the very first inkling of God moving in judgment. But it goes on to say, for all this, his anger is not spent, but his hand is still stretched out. There's much more to come. That's just a foretaste of what's yet to come. Then verse 26 through 30, we get into a pretty ominous picture that is a foreshadowing of a much more significant judgment to come. He will also lift up a standard to the distant nation, and he will whistle for it from the ends of the earth. And behold, it will come with speed swiftly. No one in it is weary or stumbles. None slumbers or sleeps. Nor is the belt at its waist undone, nor its sandal strap broken. Its arrows are sharp, and all its bows are bent. The hooves of its horses seem like flint, and its chariot wheels like a whirlwind. Its roaring is like a lioness, and it roars like young lions. It growls as it seizes the prey, and carries it off with no one to deliver it. And it shall growl over it in that day like the roaring of the sea. And if one looks to the land, behold, there is darkness and distress. Even the light is darkened by its clouds. So what it's describing is God lifting up a standard, and the standard is that to which an army rallies, which the army comes and arrays itself. So God is lifting a standard, and a whistle blows, calling this army to it, collecting this army. And all of this is happening in a distant land. And this army is going to be a mighty force. They are not tired. They are coming swiftly. And it's interesting you would say coming swiftly, because the taunters earlier had said, let him make speed, let him hasten his work. Well, there's a sense in which it is hastening. He is making speed. This army is coming, and it will come it will come quickly, rapidly. It's not tired. The belt at its waist is not undone. The sandal strap is not broken. Its arrows are sharp. Its bows are bent. The hooves of its horses seem like flint. Very important. Before the advent of horseshoes, in order for a horse to be effective, it had to have particularly strong hooves. And this is referring to horses that aren't going to give out when they run. They've got hooves that are like flint. Their feet won't wear out. And its chariot wheels like whirlwind. All of this seems to be in reference to the Assyrians. It would certainly fit with the Assyrians. The Assyrians were an army and a kingdom that developed in Mesopotamia. It was a particularly fierce people, very proud of their army, a very effective army, heavily reliant on chariots. And they did come. They came about 720, and then they come after that too. But this seems to be in reference to the Assyrians coming. Its roaring is like a lioness, and it roars like young lions. I remember, this was a number of years ago, but we were at the zoo in San Francisco at feeding time for the lions. And it was breathtaking because they, in anticipation of feeding time, they started to roar. And they would all roar one after the other, and sometimes more than one at a time. But you could hear it all over the zoo, and it was impressive. And as we got closer, it was even more impressive. But that's the kind of roaring that it's talking about, the kind that shakes the building. That's the roaring of this of the Assyrians in anticipation of their prey, I suspect. Okay. And it shall growl over it in that day like the roaring of the sea. If one looks to the land, behold, there is darkness and distress. Even the light is darkened by its clouds. In the daytime, everything is a little bit darkened. Why is it darkened? I suspect because this huge army's coming, has stirred up a cloud of dust, and that dust makes it a little bit darker. It's like a cloudy day because of all that dust. And it's ominous, and I suspect it's ominous in that that army is leaving a swath of destruction in its wake. And that's what's coming. Okay. So, as I mentioned before, where are we in Isaiah? I want to keep track of the structure of the book as far as we've gotten. Chapter 1 charted out the basic problem. The basic problem was Israel's refusal to recognize the care and provision that God had provided for it. Remember the image that even the dumb ox and donkey knows who feeds it, but you don't know who takes care of you. So that's the basic problem, a kind of rebelliousness against the one who has, later on using the image of the vineyard, the one who prepared the vineyard, and they won't recognize what God has done for them, and therefore don't recognize what kind of God he is. Chapters 2 through 5 then go on and expand on this, and the main themes that come through is that Israel is going to be disciplined for its rebelliousness. Its idols are going to be shown to be the worthless things that they are. They will be shown to be incapable of providing the security and safety that the Israelites have been looking to them to provide. And there will be a cleansing and a purifying that will take place. And all that will be left after that cleansing and purifying is a remnant. But that remnant will be a holy remnant. And that Israel has a glorious future that awaits it. That once that purifying takes place, there will be a truly glorious role in history that Israel is going to play, and that the Israelites ought to live in a way that is appropriate to that future that awaits them. And along the way, in chapters 2 through 5, there are hints of an imminent judgment that's going to come. That involves some kind of apparently a siege, a deprivation of food and water, and then capture and enslavement and exile. All those are kind of hinted at. Now, in the next chapter, it's going to talk about Isaiah when he's first called to be a prophet, and then it's going to proceed from there into his apparently early on in his years as a prophet. There are a couple of things that are worthy of note here that I'd like to point out. The first thing is the curious double perspective on history that Isaiah is presenting here, and it becomes clearer even later. This issue will come up again. But in talking about God setting up a standard and calling the army to it, it's as if the Assyrian army has been assembled by God. But if you were to do a study of the history of Assyria, the way that we do studies of the histories of any kingdom, I'm sure that what you would find is that the Assyrians decided to assemble an army and proceed westward for typical political reasons. That if you were to ask the Assyrians, why did you go to Palestine? They would say, because it was there and there was wealth there, and it was easy pickings. They're going to say something like that. They are not going to say, because God sent us. So there's this double perspective on history. On the one hand, what's driving the Assyrians is probably the kinds of things that drive people and countries to do what they do all the time. The Assyrians are doing what an aggressive, imperialistic kingdom at that time did. That's just what you do. You see a vacuum of power where there's wealth, you go get it. You take the wealth, you give it to your army, you give it to your nobility, and everybody's happy. But from God's perspective, from Isaiah's perspective, this has all been orchestrated by God. Just recently, just a couple months ago, I was listening to a lecture about the Cyrus cylinder. It's a cylinder that has been found, still exists, written in, I believe it's in cuneiform letters, stamped into a piece of clay. And it is the document that says that Cyrus the Persian was going to allow the peoples in, and I can't remember whether it lists Israel specifically or not, I think it does, that gives permission for the Israelites to go back to Jerusalem. That exists. We have it. It's in the museum in Jerusalem. And then there are copies, I think, well, maybe the copies in Jerusalem and the real one is in Babylon, in Iraq. I can't remember. But it exists. And the guy was lecturing about that, and he was saying that he knew that it says in the Bible that God was going to appoint Cyrus to send the Jews back to Jerusalem. But he said, in fact, he was doing something that any wise ruler in his position would do. The Persian Empire was a multi-ethnic empire. The Assyrians practice, and the Babylonians before them, had conquered people, and then they would take some of the people that they had conquered and move them to a different part of their empire. And as a result, they aroused a lot of animosity towards Babylonian rule. The Persians decided that because they had a multi-ethnic kingdom, they needed all those ethnic groups on their side. So Cyrus developed this policy of returning those peoples to their homelands in order to win their favor and to create support for his rule. Well, that makes all kinds of sense. But that's the other perspective on the history. That's, humanly speaking, why Cyrus did what he did. But behind it all, God was orchestrating events. God was the one who appointed Cyrus to send the Jews back to Jerusalem. So that double perspective on history, I think, is important, and we need to keep it in mind. The other thing I want to talk about is the relevance of Isaiah for us. Isaiah is talking to the people of Judah and Jerusalem in sometime in the 8th century B.C., and the question is, what is the relevance of what he's saying to us? Or does it have any relevance? And I think the answer clearly is, yes, it has extreme relevance for us. Firstly, we as human beings are all subject to the same foibles that the Jews were. It is easy to look back at the Jews and say, why were they so stupid? But the reality is, if we get any clarity on a vision on ourselves, we're made of the same stuff. We do the same kinds of things. We may not bow down before idols, but we erect other kinds of idols that we invest trust in that's appropriate only for God. And sorting that out and seeing where we do that is an important task. But we are just as subject to those kinds of temptations as they were, and fall down just as readily. Secondly, Israel is an interesting experiment on God's part. God chose to take the Israelites out of all of the world. He picked one group of people, a small group of people, and he decided that he was going to invest himself in that people in a way that he did not invest himself in the rest of the world. It's his place where he reaches down into world history and is involved. As a result, we can see God in his dealings with Israel in a way that we can't see God in his dealings with other peoples in the world. He communicates with them through his prophets. And he critiques what they're doing. He responds to what they're doing in a way that he doesn't with us. In Plato's Republic, it's an exploration of what justice is. And in order to explore what justice is, Socrates decides that it would be appropriate to look at just, and he's in particular, justice in a human being. What makes a just human being? And he says, in order to understand what justice is, it's better to look at it in big letters. He likens it to looking at small letters. Well, they're hard to read. But if you have big letters, it's a lot easier to read. So let's take individual justice, which is like little letters, and blow that up into big letters. Well, why would you do that? And he says, well, let's look at justice in a city rather than in an individual. Let's see what a just city would look like. And so he goes on to talk about a just city. Well, God, I think, has done a similar thing with respect to Israel, in that as individuals, we are little letters. But God, in his dealings with Israel, is dealing with big letters. And so we can see God dealing with the nation of Israel in magnified form. It's the same God. It's human beings that are like us. And we can see the interaction between the two. And the way that God interacts with Israel is significant for us, in the same way that if we take a father and son relationship, father and two sons, how the father deals with son number one is very relevant for son number two. It may not be the father dealing directly with son number two, but everything that the father does with respect to son number one is evidence of what kind of father he is, what that father values, how that father is going to respond to various kinds of things on the part of son number one. So everything that's said, everything that is done in that relationship between the father and son number one is relevant for son number two. We are son number two. And everything that happens in that relationship between God and Israel is relevant to us because it tells us a lot about who God is, what he values, and what he's up to. And I just wrote down just a few things that I think scream at us from the history of Israel and God's dealings with the history of Israel. One is how good and generous God is becomes apparent. Secondly, how human beings are prone to wickedness, that the Israelites so easily took God for granted. We do the same thing. But God is patient and forbearing, and his patience is something that's underscored many, many times. And I think that that's an important aspect of God's character that we can count on. But that he disciplines those that he loves. And one of the things that's striking in the history of Israel is how harsh that discipline can be. If you look at what the nation of Israel has experienced over the years, the persecutions that have occurred, how many times and in how many places and in how many ways. I mean, and even coming down to the Nazi period and the Holocaust, it is astounding what the nation of Israel has been subjected to. And yet that's all God's discipline. I find that very interesting because as I apply that personally, God is willing to put us through very, very difficult things. It doesn't mean he doesn't love us. It's all part of his discipline. He's accomplishing his purposes. But to think that he will not allow us to go through difficult times is absurd in the light of the biblical record. That God does not lose those that he has in his hands. God is faithful to those that he has chosen. And God is faithful to his promises. One of the things that I am extremely thankful for, and something that we in our time are uniquely privileged to be able to benefit from, is the fact that there is a nation of Israel where it is located at this particular point in time, it is amazing to me that God promised to Abraham that Abraham's descendants would possess the land of Palestine. And we know from the biblical record that it was foretold that they would be dispersed from that land after they did arrive in numbers coming from Egypt. Then they were dispersed into the exile. And then they were dispersed again after the destruction of the temple. And they've gone all over the world. And now, a millennium later, there is actually a nation of Jews living on the land that God promised to give to Abraham. I think that is absolutely astounding. And if you look at how it came to be, one of the things that's fascinating is those who were the leaders of the Zionist movement weren't even religious Jews. They had just decided, as a result of their experience in Europe, that Jews were going to have to live separate from Gentiles. They were not going to be able to live together. So they decided they needed their own country, but they didn't care where it was. They explored the possibility of Madagascar, Cyprus, other places. But kind of by default, they ended up in Palestine. There's, again, the two perspectives on history. One is the Zionists doing what they're doing, why they're doing it. And the other is God orchestrating things. Clearly, God returned the people, the Jews, back to Israel. And I look at that and I think there are times when it's easy in looking at your own life's circumstances to think that God has forgotten you, that things have spun out of control or there is no God, and that it's all a fantasy. The biblical perspective is a fantasy. It does not match reality. That God is not there, that God will not be my rescuer. But one thing that I can always come back to that's always reassuring to me is, but Israel is in Israel. And that's an astounding historical fact. You can go there and see it. It's there. That's an astounding fact. Something that God had foretold long ago, a promise that he had made long ago, he has carried out. We'll see what happens from here. I don't know what's going to happen from here exactly. But God has kept his promise. And I think that we can count on him being willing and able to keep the promise that he has made with respect to us. So the relevance of Isaiah to us is, I think, enormous. It's very relevant. And I hope you can sense that. Okay. Questions, comments?
The canopy that's talked about in chapter 4, is that why they use canopies in Jewish weddings to symbolize God's provision?
I don't know. I don't know at all. That would be an interesting question. I think in this particular case, that basically this is a symbol of God's protection over what form that canopy will take in this particular prophecy, I don't know. But whether that symbol then has been appropriated in Jewish customs, I don't know. But that's an interesting possibility.
I guess I'd like to speak to the kind of the solidarity of God from the standpoint that he provides a consistent message to all humanity, and that the receptivity of man towards God's sovereignty or goodness is really based on whether God has chosen that person or not in the way that he has chosen Israel. I was watching a documentary the other day on the psychology of dogs, and they did a study and got several dozen wild wolf cubs that were just newborn, and they were treated, and they said that genetically the wolves were 98% the same as a regular domesticated dog. And each of the cubs was given an owner that was lovingly bottle fed them and raised them as they would raise a dog or as they would raise a child. And all of the wolves at 8 weeks became vicious and violent and were unable to respond as a domestic dog would respond. And I guess the point I'm making is that through hardship, it isn't our will or our ingenuity that keeps us in God's hands, but it's God choosing us. He either made us a dog or he didn't.
Yeah.
And we should, as Israel should, be grateful that we've been made a dog, that we've been made somebody that is receptive, that can respond to being bottle fed and being cared about.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah.
Well, first, I really am appreciating this series.
Thanks.
And especially these last comments. So the question that it aroused for me is seeing just how harsh and severe and willing God is to discipline Israel and then us.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, especially in Isaiah, well, in lots of the Old Testament, but in Isaiah, I mean, women growing scabs, losing their hair.
Yep.
It's intense and ugly and nasty.
It is.
And yet there's the hope that it's not for nothing. And for us then, you know, going to our life, my life. And so the question occurred, is everything, I could say unwanted or difficult, is all of my suffering, hardship, is all of it a gift from God? Is it all meant for discipline?
I believe the answer is yes. I don't know that we can know exactly what God is trying to accomplish by the things that he brings into our lives. But he is committed to working in our lives to create in us the kinds of hearts that he wants. And that is apparently major surgery. It takes extreme measures to accomplish the purposes that he's accomplishing. And our trust is that everything that we experience in our life, both good and bad, contributes to the goal that the treatment that he is carrying out in our lives. And that's what sustains us through it. That's why it's so critical to recognize that. That's what sustains us through it. And if we don't recognize that, then it's easy to get to fall in despair in the midst of it.
Yeah, and I think for me what I'm realizing is that sometimes with the really big, hard things, there's almost like sometimes a grace that comes that makes it clear, like obviously this is from God.
Absolutely.
And I think
and
that...
Some, and in my experience, sometimes not.
Definitely, right. And then there are those other things that might not be as profound or dramatic,
right.
But more chronic,
yes.
And low-level irritating or
absolutely.
Or just, you know, difficult, that I think I can be seduced into not recognizing that is indeed for me. It's a measure of discipline for me.
Absolutely.
And so, that distinction, like clarifying that everything
mm-hmm.
that he does
yes.
is for that goal.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
I too want to thank you. It's been really
thanks.
Wonderful. You mentioned your last comment was it's relevant to us because it reflects God's faithfulness to his promises to us.
Mm-hmm.
And perhaps it's obvious, but I thought it would be helpful for you to highlight the ones that you're thinking of in particular.
Well, that I will be made perfect. Mm-hmm. That's what ultimately God is working on a process in me and in any believer to bring them to the point of perfection where they will be inherently righteous. And as I think about things, that is such a valuable thing to me that as long as I can keep in perspective that what I'm going through is contributing to that end, it makes it okay. And if I know that God's promised that and will be faithful to that promise, that's it's okay by me to go through what I'm going through. Just one more, then we'll have to let the kids go.
You were listing off the four different people, the four different forms of idolatry that Isaiah spoke to. And I think the third one was clever people. And I was thinking about what their idol was. And I think it was themselves. They valued like their personality and their cleverness and that kind of stuff, which is often something that I rely on. And I'm like, I'm clever enough to get through this. I can figure it out, or I've got what it takes. But there are some points in my life where I realize how incapable I am of even taking care of myself and keeping myself healthy morally and spiritually and all that. And then I come to realize just how lost I am, and how how I'm simply undone without God taking care of me. And it's only by remembering that at least once in my life, God has taken care of me, and that it, like that promise in the New Testament where he says that if God's taken care of you once, he'll continue that work until Christ comes. Very sustaining thing.
It is a very sustaining thing. Thanks. Okay, thanks.